This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott.
Now, my mama's always telling me how miracles happen every day. Some people don't think so.
Jenny!
But they do.
Sorry, Forrest Gump. According to statistician David Hand, miracles happen about once a month. Moreover, what we consider a miracle is really just a mathematical probability. He digs into the data on that and other supposed flukes in his new book, The Improbability Principle, Why Coincidences, Miracles, and Rare Events Happen Every Day. David Hand is Emeritus Professor of Mathematics and Senior Research Investigator at Imperial College in London and joins us now on Word of Mouth. Thank you for being here.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
So first of all, what is the improbability principle?
Okay, I encapsulate the improbability principle in a single sentence. Improbable events are commonplace. It's obviously a sort of contradiction from that. But what it really says is that these extraordinary coincidences, highly improbable events, things that you would expect never to see because they're so improbable, in fact, do happen and happen with a startling frequency. People winning the lottery twice, or let me take another example, with the same lottery numbers coming up 1 week after another, exactly the same numbers, jackpot winning numbers coming up. You would think that that's so unlikely it's not going to happen.
And
but
that's
it has happened. It has happened. It's happened more than once, yes. It happened in 2009 in the Bulgarian state lottery, for instance. The numbers came up once, and then just in the next draw, just a few days later, exactly the same numbers came up, caused a national outcry. The Bulgarian sports minister ordered an investigation. But it's the sort of thing you should expect to happen according to the improbability principle.
Now, can you really put a number on how often these miraculous or highly improbable events occur?
You can. Some sort of events are easier to put numbers on than others. Lotteries are quite easy to put numbers on because they're stripped away of all the sort of uncertainties and ambiguities of definitions. You know how many lottery tickets there are. You can calculate the probability that any one will be a winner. You can therefore calculate the probability that identical numbers will come up. So for that sort of example, it's easy to put a number on it. For others, like the chance of being killed by lightning, which is obviously a rare event, one hopes, it's also possible to put numbers on them, but harder. And then for other things, the probability of two related people being involved in train crashes, for instance, which is one of the examples in my book, it's tougher still. So you can put numbers on them, but as you drift away from things which are, in some sense, purely mathematical, lotteries or tossing coins or throwing dice or playing cards or whatever, to things which involve humans more, it becomes tougher to put numbers on. But you can still talk about ballpark figures. You can say, is this, in fact, quite likely, or is it a one in a million or a one in a billion sort of chance?
Well, I guess we've all experienced strange coincidences, you know, maybe running into somebody that we were just thinking about quite randomly. And we remember those. We remember the sort of hits and, I guess, forget all of the misses. How often do those hits really happen?
Yes, you put your finger on something there. The improbability principle consists of five sort of mathematical type laws, but that's coupled with the human tendency to notice certain things, ignore the many other things, the many millions of other events which are sort of boiling and buzzing around us, and just select the ones which have sort of meaning for us. So that you look at these and think, wow, what's the chance of that, ignoring all the other stuff that's going on? And I think there's a very good evolutionary sort of reason for us recognizing, noticing, and paying attention to these sorts of things. And it's that we've evolved to notice patterns so that, for instance, if you see the movement in the grass, you think, uh-oh, there's a tiger there, I might get eaten, and you run away. If we hadn't evolved in this way, we wouldn't survive.
Has that impulse, however, for the miraculous changed over time? I mean, now we live in an era where we have so much data that is available to us, and a quick Google search could explain a coincidence, let's say. Do you understand what I'm saying? Do you think that's changed in the age of, you know, statistics and Nate Silver?
I would like to think it has, but I'm sure it hasn't. We're still human beings. And I suppose this is illustrated by the fact that when I see one of these rare coincidences, so for instance, I had an experience a few years ago, 2012, I went to the Royal Statistical Society conference in Telford, a town in the UK, and I went up to the reception desk to register, and I said, I'm David Hand. And she said, "You're the second David Hand with us this week." And I thought, good Lord, how extraordinary. What a coincidence. I must arrange to meet this other, this imposter. So you still are amazed by it, even if you can understand the numbers behind it.
We're speaking about The Improbability Principle. It's a new book by David Hand. He's an emeritus professor of mathematics. He's helping to explain why coincidences, miracles, and rare events actually happen every single day. Can The Improbability Principle explain why some people think they're lucky and others think they're unlucky?
Yes, I think it can. I mean, if you look at chance events happening to people around the world, even if we all had the same degree of luck, so good events and bad events were happening to all of us at the same sort of rate, purely by chance, some of those people would experience in a given day, for instance, more good events, and other people would experience more bad events. And to them, as individuals, it would look like, wow, everything that happens to me is good. I'm just very lucky. And for the other guys, they'd think, wow, everything that happens to me is bad. You know, life is a disaster. But it's just random variation, just chance. So it's like flipping a coin. If I have 100 people all flipping coins, some people are going to get a lot of strings of heads in a row, others are going to get a lot of strings of tails in a row, most people are going to get a nice mix of the things. But there are going to be these people with lots of heads and lots of tails.
All right, so let's talk about somebody who sounds pretty unlucky, a man named Roy Sullivan. You write about him in the book. He was struck by lightning not once, but 8 times. So maybe it's a sign for him to spend more time inside. But you say that this fact is not that improbable. Why?
Yeah, he's a nice example of one of the other laws of the improbability principle, the law of the probability lever. So in America, the chance of being hit by lightning is 1 in 3 million. Mm-hmm. About 100 people in America are killed by lightning every year. It's a pretty small number. So to get hit by lightning so many times over the course of your life, you would think, yeah, he must be a really unfortunate guy right out in the tails of a distribution, very, very unlucky. And that would be true if he was sort of a random representative person from America. He spent most of his time driving to the office, working in the office and so on. But it turns out, in fact, that he was a park ranger. He spent most of his time wandering around Virginia Park across fields. He's much more likely to be struck by lightning with that sort of job. So what's happened is that the circumstances, the conditions have been slightly shifted away from one's perceptions. He's not what one might call a normal person working in an office. He does something which predisposes him, makes him particularly vulnerable to this sort of event. So for him, it wasn't so unlikely, and that was demonstrated by him being struck so many times.
It's another great story in the book about Sir Anthony Hopkins. Would you tell that to us?
Of course, yeah. So in 1972, Anthony Hopkins was playing a starring role in a film called The Girl from Petrovka, based on George Pfeiffer's book. And Hopkins went to London to buy a copy of the book. He went around all the bookstores but couldn't find a copy, so he'd given up, and he was waiting for a tube train to go home when he saw a book on the seat next to him. He picked it up and saw it was, in fact, a copy of The Girl from Petrovka, the very book he'd been looking for. He looked inside it and saw some annotations. Somebody had written some notes in the book. And later, when he met the author, George Pfeiffer, he showed him this book. George Pfeiffer looked at these notations in the book and said, "Good Lord, this is a copy of the book I was making corrections, changes to, amending the English spelling to American spelling. And I lent it to a friend, and my friend lost it." This had been months before Anthony Hopkins found it. But somehow it had travelled through time and space back to George Pfeiffer, the very same copy of the book. There's a corollary to this, in fact. After I'd spoken about this same anecdote some time ago, the author, George Pfeiffer, contacted me. He emailed me and said, "Yes, that's what happened, and we're trying to arrange to meet up."
What a story. But I wonder if that gives us some hope, doesn't it, in some way, Professor Hand, this idea that miracles can happen. For example, the statistics would tell us we're really unlikely to win the lottery, but we keep continuing to play and buy tickets. What does this improbability offer us in the way of hope?
It does, doesn't it? It offers us hope, and indeed that's why people continue to play the lottery. But I think for any particular one individual winning the lottery, you know, the chance is still very small. There are strategies you can adopt which will increase either your chance, or either the amount you win were you to win, or indeed your probability of winning. But the probabilities are still pretty small. And if you do want to make a fortune, That's not a particular route I would recommend.
But rationality, on the other hand, reducing all of this miraculous, coincidental, kismet to mathematics is kind of a bummer.
this is my point, really. I don't think it is. I don't think it detracts from the sense of wonder. When one of these things happens to me, I don't think, yeah, well, I would have expected it. My first reaction is always, gosh, wow. You know, what an extraordinary thing. So the first time I went to New Zealand, I was just sitting in a cafe and I noticed that the two people, the complete strangers, sitting at the neighbouring table, one of them gave a business card to the other one, and it was a business card from my own university in the UK. I had no idea who they were, but clearly they were from the same institution back home. And I thought, wow, what's the chance of that? And, you know, you can then do the calculations and work out the chance of that and decide whether it is so improbable after all. The initial shock, as it were, the initial amazement is still there.
Well, David Hand, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
David Hand, Emeritus Professor of Mathematics and a Senior Research Investigator at Imperial College in London. He's author of the book The Improbability Principle, Why Coincidences, Miracles, and Rare Events Happen Every Day. We do have a link to more on the book at wordofmouthradio.org. Up next, we continue to press our luck with a look into the world of online sweepstakes. Yes, people really do win those things. That's when Word of Mouth returns after a short break.
Word of Mouth!
They're all over your Facebook page and your spam folder, those blinking sweepstake ads offering free vacations, laptop computers, and cars. But who enters those contests? And does anyone actually win? Laura Mayer and On the Media's podcast TLDR bring us the story.
A couple weeks ago, our colleague Laura Mayer told us she was interested in doing a story about online sweepstakes. I was under the impression that these were probably as reliable as those make thousands of dollars working from home ads. But she wanted to pull back the curtain on what she said was a pretty vibrant subsector of the internet that neither PJ nor I really interact with. Laura?
So I'm really into making passive income, the money you don't really need to do a whole lot, but think wildly to earn. To give you some examples, a few years ago, I got my cat in a Fresh Step commercial, and he earned $200 from his appearance. Last year, I won a social media contest and became Red Lobster's Lobstar of the Week. And I tried to turn that into a brand ambassadorship, which didn't really work out. So when my friend Rebecca told me that she has a new scheme to make money just from the internet, I got interested.
So I wake up, I make a cup of coffee, and then I kind of sit down and get started.
Rebecca's been in the sweepstakes game every single day since she got back from working in Korea a few months ago. She's looking for work at the moment. But in the meantime, she decided to see how much money she could make just from the internet.
I start with the instant sweepstakes. This Chef Boyardee Daily Instant Win, they're giving away 5 Xboxes every day. There's a FIFA World Cup Brazil sweepstakes where you have to send in a picture of your team, which is like friends or family. So no one in my family knows this, but I've been sending in pictures of them every day to try and win a trip to Brazil for me and my boyfriend.
Rebecca's not alone. There's a very rich online community attached to sweepstaking. There are message boards where sweepstakers hang out all day, every day. And like any community, there are leaders. Sandra Groshoff is About.com's official sweepstakes expert.
A few years ago, a friend of mine asked me what I thought about sweepstakes, and I said, well, they're all scams, aren't they? Nobody ever really wins them. But he challenged me to give them a try, so I entered just a few, and it turns out I won.
The first thing she won? An Xbox game. A few months later, she won an Xbox console. Pretty soon, through pure stick-to-itiveness, she won a room full of furniture from Cargo Kids, a one-of-a-kind shopping spree at Prada, and a ton of other stuff. But even though she enters 50 sweepstakes a day and has run a sweepstakes newsletter for 7 years, she's actually got a kind of zen attitude about the whole enterprise.
Sweepstakes are all about the journey, not the destination. The destination's really nice when you get there. I mean, sweepstakes can change your entire life.
One sweepstakes in particular, the granddaddy of all sweepstakes, HGTV's Dream Home Sweepstakes, which every year gives one lucky winner a multi-million dollar, fully furnished mansion.
It's big, bold, and beautiful, with sophisticated Western charm, fabulous furnishings, fun surprises, and a friendly come-on-in East Texas welcome that's guaranteed to warm your heart. This is HGTV's Dream Home 2005.
My name is Donald Cruz. I'm the HGTV Dream Home winner 2005.
Don Cruz is a carpet layer from Illinois. The day he won the 2005 HGTV Dream Home Sweepstakes started out as a sad one. A family friend had just passed away when a fleet of shiny SUVs and a camera crew pulled into his driveway.
HGTV pulled an Ed McMahon and came out and surprised me. The cameraman came out, turned the camera on. The boom mic guy lowered a boom mic over my head. They put spotlights on me. And everybody was piling out of the cars but going on the opposite side of the cars. And I was asking, what's going on? You know, can I help you? They came running around and said, surprise, you win.
Don moved his entire family from his home in Batavia, Illinois, down to Tyler, Texas. As a carpet layer, Don had been in huge mansions before. But this home was his.
It was like a dream come true. On a lake, it had a swimming pool, a hot tub. You walk in the great room, and it's 30-foot ceilings. It had 10 wood beams that cost over $100,000 each. The master bedroom alone was 1,000 square feet with a shower so big that you could have 10 people get in the shower, take their picture, and nobody bumps into anybody.
If you think this sounds too good to be true, well, you're right. There's a catch. When the Cruises won the Dream Home, they were slapped with a $680,000 tab from the IRS. That's true for all of the HGTV winners. Everyone else immediately sold the house to avoid being crushed by taxes. But Don and his family actually wanted to live in their dream home.
People from all over the world were sending us ideas to be able to raise money to pay the taxes. We had planned on using the house as a bed and breakfast to raise money to pay the taxes for winning the house. People from the HGTV message board were contacting us saying, if you get to do it, put us on the list. And we were getting offers of $3,000 for the boathouse per night and $2,000 a night for the master bedroom.
It was a good plan on paper, but the city of Tyler wouldn't give the Cruises the permits they needed to run a B&B. So they were stuck. Don fell behind on the tax payments for the dream home and then fell behind on the mortgage payments for his old house in Illinois. And then, in the midst of all this financial stress, something much worse happened. Don's wife, Shelley, found out she had a hematoma in her brain. She needed surgery.
They needed the money up front for the surgery. There's no making payments to doctors like us.
Don didn't have the money, but he had the dream home. Don took out a mortgage to pay his wife's medical bills. It turned out there was a great brain surgeon in Tyler, and they had another resource to lean on, the HGTV online sweepstakers community. When Don talks about the sweepers he met online, he still refers to them by their usernames.
E-Tex Bill, Mussy, Tyler Rose, Robo Lady, all these people and hundreds of others that we met through the message board were all very helpful, prayed for my wife.
Sweepstakers flew to Tyler from all across the country just to be there for the surgery.
We had people on the second floor waiting room full, the first floor waiting room full, and out the hospital doors, all from people from around the United States that came in just to give their support for my wife when she was having surgery. And these were all people we had met through winning the house, which was, it was pretty powerful. It was pretty awesome.
Shelley fully recovered, but the Cruises lost their house to foreclosure in 2008. They live back in Illinois now, in the same house they lived in before the dream home changed their lives. You hear a lot of stories about people who win something big, like the lottery, and then suffer so much misfortune that they end up wishing they hadn't. But the difference between winning the lottery and winning the HGTV Dream Home Sweepstakes is that when you win the lottery, you're alone with your money. Even just by entering the sweepstakes, Don got a community of strangers who cared enough about him to fly to Texas and sit with him in a hospital waiting room. So even though he lost the mansion, he doesn't regret it. He's not bitter.
Best vacation I ever went on, I do everything exactly the same.
Are you still entering sweepstakes?
Actually, yes, ma'am. I just got through entering a few minutes ago, just before you called, to win the one at Tahoe.
Well, here's hoping. Is there anything else you'd like to add that I haven't asked you?
Yes. If you're listening, go to HGTV.com right now and enter to win the dream home. There's nothing more exciting than winning the house and going on winter's weekend. It is a blast. You'll love it.
Don Cruz. You can check out his ebook, The Life of an HGTV Dream Home Winner, at his website, doncruz.net.
And that's Laura Mayer from the TLDR podcast. It was the selfie tweeted around the world. We're all calling it Ellen's Oscar photo, but Bradley Cooper was the one who actually snapped the shot. So who owns it? That question answered when Word of Mouth continues after the news.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Earlier this month, the 2014 Academy Awards boasted its best ratings in a decade. Though the broadcast itself didn't break any records, host Ellen DeGeneres' star-studded Oscar selfie did.
Meryl, here's my idea, okay? So you are nominated, it's a record-breaking 18 times, right? So I thought we would try to break another record right now with the most retweets of a photo.
My arm's definitely better.
Okay. That's it. Hey, that's good. Look at us.
Nice.
Now, I say Ellen's star-studded Oscar selfie, but truthfully, it was Best Actor nominee Bradley Cooper who took the photo. So who exactly owns the rights to this now iconic picture that was retweeted more than 2 million times? Philip Bump is staff writer for The Atlantic Wire, where he wrote about what the selfie seen around the world says about copyright in the age of the smartphone. Philip, great to have you with us.
Thank you.
So who could hypothetically come forward and claim ownership or maybe even co-ownership of the Oscar selfie, do you think?
A surprisingly large number of people.
Well, let's run through the players.
Sure. Well, they're most of Hollywood. Basically, everyone that appears in the photo can, to some extent, claim the co-ownership over it in certain contexts. If you're doing the most immediate legal interpretation, the most likely owner of it is the ever-handsome Bradley Cooper, and that is solely by virtue of the fact that he was handed the phone from Ellen DeGeneres and is the person that pushed the shutter button. And that in and of itself makes him the primary owner of the photograph, according to the law.
But if you listen to the tape, he says that he'll take the photo, and Ellen says, no, I'm doing it. Let's just hear a little bit from that.
Jennifer, come in also.
I'll take it.
Brad, get in here.
I'll take it.
No, I'm doing it. Angie?
Now, the moment seems to get away from her. Do you think she might have been aware of the possible copyright implications when she initiated this selfie?
I suspect that was not at the forefront of her mind. It's possible, I suppose. I mean, I think one of the outstanding questions is, it seems apparent that the phone that was provided, which was a Samsung phone, was provided with the goal that it be incorporated into the broadcast. And so one of the questions we looked at, too, was if Samsung said, hey, take a selfie with all of these celebrities, does Samsung have a claim to the photo at the expense of either Ellen or Bradley? And according to the people we spoke with, no, that's not the case, that Bradley still is the person who is the primary owner of the photo by virtue of having taken it, particularly because if Ellen did agree to take the photo for Samsung and had an agreement with Samsung, Bradley is not bound by that agreement.
But it, does it mean anything that Ellen sort of directed and initiated the photograph?
It does, and actually that's where her claim of co-ownership can come into it. There is a legal case that one of the attorneys that we spoke with called Broad versus General Publishing, in which a photographer had worked with a writer on producing a series of photographs. When the writer then made a book out of them, the photographer sued, saying that he had ownership. But the court found that because the writer had had a hand in composing the shots and identifying the best shots out of the group, that he was able to be a co-owner of it. And to that extent, the experts that we spoke with suggested that Ellen would have a similar claim if this ended up in a very hotly contested legal case over ownership of the photo, that was a case that she might be able to make.
Okay, so if it did go to court, Bradley Cooper would win copyright. Ellen would likely win co-copyright, correct?
Yes, co-ownership of it. And the question is the extent to which the other people who are pictured in this shot contributed to its composition. So,
yeah,
for example,
I can imagine it coming up if somebody really hated their picture in this shot and said, I want this taken down.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it seems as though the cat's out of the barn on that one, or however the expression goes. The act of putting together the photo itself raises ownership questions, but it was the pushing of the button that really set Bradley's claim apart.
This seems so strange to me, though, Philip. I mean, if a tourist hands his or her camera to a stranger to take a photo of them in front of, the Washington Monument, the stranger owns the photo?
That's correct. That is what the law says. You know, part of this is, you know, the legal determination of who owns the copyright to a photo vastly predates all of us having cameras in our pockets that we use incessantly. And so back when it was a professional photographer setting up a shot and pulling the trigger, that was a different situation than it is now, in which we all have cameras with us, we hand them around. And yes, you should know that if you give someone your phone, they take a prize-winning photo with it, the odds are good that it is their photo, not yours.
Well, how about Twitter? They boasted about breaking Twitter. Is there any ownership for Twitter being the medium on which this photo was uploaded and shared?
Twitter has had questions raised in the past about the extent to which it owns photographs. It is really not in Twitter's interest to claim ownership over the photo, because there are a lot of things that are shared on Twitter which are copyright violations. And so that makes a somewhat tricky legal area for Twitter to start saying that they have the right to these photos. They claim the right, obviously, to republish the photos, but if they were to start claiming ownership, then that opens up a whole other legal spectrum, which they very wisely would want to avoid.
So what I'm hearing from you is that maybe the law has not yet caught up with the technology, but it seems sort of strange to be wondering who owns a digital photograph, given that there's no negative, there are no original prints. It's really a copyright or ownership of ones and zeros.
That's exactly right. But, I mean, the same goes for any digital medium. You know, the author of a book, which is distributed in an electronic format, you could say the same thing. Movies that are shared over iTunes or downloaded illegally. There are a lot of these questions that exist about something which is infinitely replicable and which doesn't have any sort of physical form. Regardless, it's important to figure out who owns these things. Less so in this case, obviously, but in general, this is something that the law is still trying to figure out how it's going to deal with.
Philip Bump, staff writer for The Atlantic, thank you for your time.
Of course, my pleasure.
You can find a link to read the article for yourself at wordofmouthradio.org. There's book smart, there's street smart, and personality smart. Up next, we're going to talk to a doctor trying to measure personal intelligence. Word of Mouth reads the cues after the break. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Among those applauding the announcement last week that the College Board will be making sweeping alterations to the SAT exam were opponents of standardized tests in general. There's been an ongoing debate over whether IQ or other measures define intelligence based on narrow cultural norms. Standardized tests cannot quantify physical or emotional intelligence, for example. To that, University of New Hampshire psychology professor John D. Mayer would add personal intelligence. He's going to be speaking at the Water Street Bookstore in Exeter on this Thursday, March 13th, to promote his new book, Personal Intelligence: The Power of Personality and How It Shapes Our Lives. And John Mayer, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Virginia. It's a pleasure to be here.
So what is personal intelligence?
So I define personal intelligence as the ability to reason about personality and the cues and clues to people's personalities that are around them. And by the reasoning, I mean, for example, being able to connect different parts of personality and know that they go together. And to go one way that we have of measuring this, for example, is to ask people about how well they perceive patterns of personality. And we might ask a question like this. Suppose a woman prefers to be around people rather than to be by herself and is very talkative. Is she more likely to be A, anxiety prone and sensitive, or B, full of energy and lively? And the answer to that question is B, full of energy and lively, because energy and liveliness are more likely to go together with being outgoing and being talkative than are being anxiety prone and oversensitive.
Your book does feature several studies showing how people judge each other. Maybe some examples from you of how people tend to get it right, what kind of cues they pick up on, and how they tend to get it wrong.
Well, I think that observant people begin to learn that certain cues about a person go together. For example, promptness is a sign, maybe a sign that a person is conscientious and dutiful. Maybe a messy desk might be a sign that a person's a bit creative. So we look for clues and we try to connect it to patterns of their behavior. Another way that we get it right up to a point is that we learn certain personalities in depth, and usually those personalities are in the family that we've grown up in. So we learn how to predict our mom's behavior and our dad's behavior. We know if we do something that's going to irritate them, and if we do something else that might please them. Now, what we begin to do as we leave our family is we assume that other people are going to behave in the same way.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't always, because people are so varied. So one of the things that people with higher personal intelligence do, or people who use their personal intelligence, is they start to realize, this person reminds me of my mother, but they're not my mother, and they're going to behave somewhat differently.
Are there some historical figures that come to mind that you suspect had a really high degree of personal intelligence?
Well, psychologists often point to the enormous growth that Ludwig von Beethoven went through during the time between when he was a young man and writing his Ninth Symphony. And during that time, he faced a lot of obstacles and disappointments and challenges, and particularly, he was in the process of losing his hearing, and it was clear that the doctors couldn't help him. And he continued to compose despite the personal troubles that this brought him. One of the troubles, incidentally, was that up to that point in his life, he was considered very cantankerous and rather unpleasant. And he was concerned that as he lost his hearing, people would regard him as even more unsociable, even though it wasn't his intention to be so. But he hunkered down. You know, he thought to himself, you know, I really want to do something. And one of the products of that was that today we had the Ninth Symphony to listen to. Another example would be Catherine Graham, who was publisher of the
Washington Post.
Yep. And I've looked over her memoir, and it's really full of observations about people, which are really quite striking sometimes.
It seems like there was a conscious decision to be more observant of self and others. Is personal intelligence something we can develop or grow, or is it more or less fixed by the time we become adults?
It's a little hard to demonstrate that an intelligence rises or becomes lower, but it is very easy to say that we as human beings learn. And we can improve our skills almost under any conditions. So I think it's quite possible to raise our skills with personal intelligence. And in fact, one of the delights of the book for me was to be able to take some time and look at the case examples of Catherine Graham and Beethoven and think about the expertise with which they altered their personalities and look at the tricks that they used to try to better understand the people around them and to better understand themselves.
Well, I'd love to dig deeper into that idea of tricking people. I'm considering that several tests conducted in the last decade or so have found that highly successful CEOs have an incidence of psychopathy about 4%, four times higher in the population at large. And I'm trying to understand if somebody with high personal intelligence could use their understanding of people to manipulate others, to become successful in their own right, sort of on the backs of others?
That's a really interesting question, and I don't know the answer to that right now. I suspect that there are many different ways to lead, and some leaders lead through intimidation and coercion, and other leaders lead by trying to motivate the people around them. I think with personal intelligence, a leader has an advantage, or any of us has an advantage, of knowing how other people respond to them. So some of us with high personal intelligence may say, well, I don't want to coerce other people. I'm not into controlling other people. But a different kind of leader could say, yes, I can understand the people around me, and I'm going to use that to manipulate them a little bit and to move them into places where I want them to be rather than what's in their best interests.
We're speaking with John Mayer. He's a professor of psychology at UNH and author of a new book that outlines his theory regarding what he calls personal intelligence. Here's a quote: the capacity to reason about personality and to use personality and personal information to enhance one's thoughts, plans, and life experience. You write that personal intelligence has a lot to do with whether or not we're good at identifying with our future selves. What does that mean?
Well, because we can see the patterns that we express in our lives, and because we can understand our motivations, not directly through introspection necessarily, but by watching ourselves across various situations and learning what we like to do and what we don't like to do, we are able to project out into the future some possible selves that we might become. We use our personal intelligence to compare these different possible future selves and, looking at them, say, okay, that's the self I would like to be 5, 10, or 15 years from now. And then understand that I need to set up a plan to get there. And so I think that people with personal intelligence can be very future-oriented, or I think it's advisable for them to be very future-oriented and think about the steps that might lead them to the kind of future self that they would like.
It's interesting that you put it like that. I did read your article in Salon about the actor's craft, you know, how some build it, their craft and characters from the outside in, but the person with high personal intelligence would build it from the inside out. And when you talk about somebody focusing on their future self, I think of Matthew McConaughey, who won Best Actor for his role in the Dallas Buyers Club, and pretty much talked about himself as his own hero, somebody that he aspired to be, setting it out 10 years from now. And I think of that association, you know, somebody who's focused on the future, somebody who's focused on introspection a great deal, can miss a lot in the day-to-day. Is there a case to be made that high personal intelligence can sometimes distract you from living in the present?
I think, yes. I think if a person lives that much, lives too much in the future, that they will lose some of the delights of the present. And so it's very good to keep those two things in balance. I probably err myself and think in being rather future-oriented, but I do think it's important to pull back and to appreciate the present. Now, where I thought you were going to go with the comment about Matthew McConaughey does personal intelligence also lead to a certain kind of self-involvement? And the reason that's a really interesting question to me is because it's one of the reasons why I really hesitated and felt reluctant to bring forth this theory, because I was worried about that. But the more I thought about it, the more I thought, you know, actually, if we reason well about ourselves, and if we understand that we're a lot like other people, that is a pathway to becoming caring about other people as well as ourselves, because we recognize that everybody's got personalities. And so it turns out in our research that we find that actually people who are high in personal intelligence have lower levels, for example, of narcissism than other people do.
Well, John Mayer, thank you very much for your time today.
You're welcome. It's a delight to be here. Thank you for having me.
John D. Mayer, professor of psychology at UNH and author of Personal Intelligence, The Power of Personality and How It Shapes Our Lives. He's going to be reading at the Water Street Bookstore in Exeter this Thursday. That's March 13th. There is more information on the event at wordofmouthradio.org. You can take your own personal intelligence test. There's a link on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And we wrap up today with some news from Alaska, which, in case you're wondering, does have more snow than we do. The Iditarod dog sled race ended earlier this morning with New Hampshire-born musher Allie Zirkel finishing second. Zirkle was narrowly edged out on the home stretch by Dallas Seavey, who took the crown for the second time. In 2012, Seavey became the youngest ever musher to win Iditarod at the age of 25. And now the Alaska Teen Media Institute brings us this story of even younger racers. Reporter Ishmael Stever follows a teen musher as he prepares for his biggest race, the 2011 Junior Iditarod.
I'm Seiji Takagi. I go to South Anchorage High School, and I'm 14 years old, and I am planning to run my first mid-distance race, the Junior Iditarod, in the end of February.
Seiji got started with mushing in the second grade when he was at a friend's house in Wasilla, and he was instantly hooked. That initial ride was an experience he wasn't able to get out of his head. His family eventually bought four dogs, and the training began. He's competed in sprint races all over Anchorage, and he's been training for his first Junior Iditarod. The training consisted of tying dogs to four-wheelers during the summer, and when the snow fell, that's when he brought out the sleds. A big part of his training was understanding how the dogs behave, which he learned from handling dogs for his mentor, Christine Roloffs.
If they are tired, then they will clearly show that they don't want to run anymore. A couple of them will just lay down and let themselves get dragged. In that case, I will put them in my sled so that they can rest, and if they're not doing good, if they're clearly not wanting to run anymore, then I'll just let them stay in the sled. But if they're just a little bit tired and then peek their head out and want to start running again, I'll put them back in the line and they'll be fine.
Of all the races Seiji has competed in, he doesn't have a single story that stands out. He likes the gorgeous moments of being outside. However, he has a story about his big brother who used to mush.
For the Junior Yukon Quest, he had a pretty tough race. He lost five of his dogs.
How many dogs did he have?
He started out with 10. And at the last checkpoint coming back, he only had 15 miles left, and they were about to withdraw him because, you know, the banquet had already started and he wasn't finished yet. But he wanted to keep on going, so he basically, his dogs are so tired, he put a harness on himself and pulled the dogs to the finish line for those last 15 miles. He actually walked in front of his sled, and he finished, and he got the Red Lantern, which is the award given to the last place finisher. But he finished, and he was super happy, and that race was super cold because it was down in Fairbanks and must have been like negative 30 to negative 40 degrees.
As Seiji scratches his favorite dog, Sapphire, he talks about the appreciation he holds for his sled team.
You get a big respect for the dogs because they pull you through that. They pull that heavy sled and yourself through all those harsh terrains, and you really come to love the dogs a lot. You want to be with them. You start missing them if you're away from them. Since most of the guys on my team are Christine's dogs, I only have four dogs of my own, but only two of them are in my race, so I see them every day. But most of these other guys I'm missing most of the time, and I just want to be able to train them as much as I can.
Seiji's team consists of leaders in the front to follow his commands and lead the team. Swing dogs are in the middle and pull the team. The wheel dogs are in the back of the team, and they need to be the strongest because it's their duty to change directions and turn corners. He explains what makes a good lead dog.
For the leaders, you need very serious dogs who have lots of endurance, because if your dogs, you know, if they lose their attention, then your team won't be going anywhere.
Like all athletes, Seiji's dogs require lots of food to keep them energized. During the race, that energy is crucial.
We have different race mixes. They're basically, the race mix is different types of meat, like beef, liver, etc. And they just mix those together, and it makes a really good meaty treat for the dogs. And then for other substances, we have like fish oil that we can add with the dogs that gives them lots of tasty protein.
Without his mom, a lot of this wouldn't be possible. Seiji's mom is one of his team's biggest assets. She cooks his meals, provides transportation, fixes beat-up gear, and provides moral support. She's noticed that Seiji's team keeps getting stronger and stronger.
I think it gets better every year. We know what we're doing more, so we're more organized, and we're missing fewer parts, and yeah, we're attending to more detail each time.
Spending time with the dogs has taught Seiji a lot of things.
You definitely need patience in mushing. Takes lots of strength. If you have bad patience, then definitely you won't be able to handle being out there a long time, handling the conditions, being able to feed the dogs. Also, it costs a lot. It costs money, time. You need the equipment. You need the strength to be able to handle all the pressure and problems that the dogs have and give you.
He also has advice for anyone interested in mushing.
You definitely want to try mushing. It's super fun, and even if you don't like it, then you can say you've tried it and you know what's really exciting down here in Alaska. And I would say that if you're living in Alaska, then you need to go mushing at least once in your life, since it's one of the best things you can do out here.
For the Alaska Teen Media Institute, I'm Ishmael Strever.
And for those of you wondering, Takagi finished in 12th place. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please join us for more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Zach Nugent,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.